Peace be with you. Friends, what is it about the story of the transfiguration of Jesus that just haunts us? Why has it beguiled so many artists and poets and spiritual masters over the centuries? I think it's because it speaks to the very heart of the Christian thing, the mystery and majesty of who Jesus is. Let's move step by step through this wonderful account that we have for this second Sunday of Lent. Jesus takes his inner circle of disciples, Peter, James, and John, and leads them up a high mountain. Now, we biblical readers should be accustomed to this by now. Mountains in the Bible are trysting places, places of encounter, meeting points of divinity and humanity. We're going up now above our ordinary experience, above the physical and everyday, to the properly spiritual realm. Psychologists in the 20th century talked about peak experiences, those times when we feel in contact with God, those times that we get the meaning of it all. We've all had experiences like that. They're rare, they're strange, they're oddly illuminating. They often come out of the blue, unexpectedly. We see, it's a mountaintop experience. You know how you see the whole countryside from a mountain? We get it. That's where we are now in this story. We hear that on this mountain, Jesus was transfigured before them. It's very interesting, I think, to look behind that word in English, to the Greek word being used here. The word is metamorphane. See, when we say, we hear transfigured, at least when I hear it, I think immediately of light. And we'll get to light. That's used here as part of the symbolism. But the word for transfigure is metamorphane. Of course, metamorphosis. To go beyond the form, that's what it means in Greek. Meta is beyond, morphe is form. To go beyond the form. Think of the caterpillar becoming the butterfly. Think of the tadpole becoming a frog. Think of the seed becoming a flower. They're all forms of metamorphosis. The bright light that we associate with the transfiguration is a kind of symbol or manifestation of this metamorphosis. It's such a rich idea, I think. The form of Jesus is not left behind. It's transfigured. It's elevated. It's changed into a higher key or register. Think of a square, two-dimensional figure, being raised now to three dimensions, to the level of a cube. Think of a triangle in two dimensions, being raised to three dimensions, becoming a pyramid. Neither square nor triangle is lost in this process. Rather, they're multiplied, intensified, metamorphosized. You see what I'm saying? The caterpillar isn't so much lost in the butterfly. It's elevated. The seed isn't destroyed or lost. It's transfigured, elevated into the plant. Christian dispensation is not a form of Platonism. It doesn't advocate or call for the escape of the soul from the body. That's Plato's game. That's Plotinus's game. It's not the biblical game. We speak in the creeds of looking for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. Now see, resurrection. You're getting it here. In many ways, transfiguration and resurrection mean the same thing. They're both types of metamorphosis, an elevation, an intensification, a transfiguration of the life here below. The risen Jesus is not beyond his body. He's an embodied presence. They touch him. He speaks to them. He eats with them. But it's a transfigured bodiliness. Not an ordinary, this worldly bodiliness. That's, I think, now what we're getting at in this account of the Transfiguration. Jesus giving them, as it were, a sort of sneak preview of what God intends for him at the resurrection and what he intends for all of us once we pass through the crucible of death. Again, go back to those organic, natural images, because they're very telling. Yes, in a certain way, the seed has to fall into the earth and die in order that it might be transfigured into the plant. In a certain way, the caterpillar has to die. It has to give way to allow the butterfly to appear. These lowly mortal bodies of ours, in a certain way, have to die and give way that this transfigured metamorphosis might happen. Why are the clothes of Jesus mentioned here? It says that his clothes became dazzlingly white. I think it's this. The clothes represent the external dimension of life. When we are deeply in touch with God, this communion tends to radiate outward and to make the whole of one's life brilliant. That's why the saints are often depicted with halos and as illuminating figures. It's as though the beauty and integrity of their lives radiates outward into all that they do so that it can be seen. It becomes radiant. Then we hear, "Behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, conversing with him." Now, this is a bit like saying to an American audience, then George Washington and Abraham Lincoln appeared to him. I mean, these are two of the greatest heroes of Israelite history. Moses, representing the Torah, the law. Elijah, representing prophecy. The two major divisions of the Hebrew Scriptures are represented here. The point is clear. All of Israelite salvation history is pointing to this moment and to this person. Moses and Elijah, the whole of Israelite history, are conversing with Jesus. Beautiful image, isn't it, of this conversation between them. Jesus is illumined by the Old Testament. The Old Testament is illumined by Jesus. They're in a conversation with each other. Listen, by the way, to much of Pope Benedict's recent reflections on how to read the Bible. He's recovering this idea that the Scriptures ought to be read as a great unity of mutual illumination between the Old Testament and the New. Everything a pious Jew had come to believe, that's what now is being communicated, is ordered to Jesus, conduces to Jesus, finds its illumination in Jesus. Now, at this point, permit me a brief glance at the first reading for this Sunday from the book of Genesis. We hear in this passage of the great rescue operation that Yahweh launches. He will form a people after his own heart, a people who will know how to walk in his ways and how to praise him. And this people, we hear this over and over again in the Old Testament, this people will become a beacon to the whole world. All the communities of the earth will find blessing in you. Now, there's the line from our first reading. But you can hear that echoed up and down the Old Testament. Mount Zion, the true pole of the earth, there all the tribes go up, the tribes of the Lord. Israel, you are the least of nations, but you've been chosen for the sake of the nations. A light will go forth, Isaiah tells us, to illumine the whole world. The point is this. Abraham, Moses, David, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Elijah, the whole gang is pointing toward Jesus, who is stationed now on a mountain and who has become dazzlingly white. Do you see it? He is the beacon. He is the light to the nations that Isaiah spoke of. He is. The whole point and purpose of Israel now become luminous. He's the fulfillment of the rescue operation that Israel is. Now, the voice coming from the cloud confirms it. This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. Think first now of the letter to the Hebrews. We hear there that God spoke in many and fragmentary ways through the prophets. He did indeed speak. It was God's voice speaking, but in a less than perfect way. But then the author of Hebrews says to us, now in these latter days, he has spoken to us through his Son. It's the definitive, authentic voice of God that is now speaking. Notice, please, Abraham, the first Israelite, you might say, the first of this family that God is forming, he's the one who listened to the voice of God and obeyed. That's the beginning of Israel. Up and down the centuries, that's what God's calling Israel to do, is to listen. Deuteronomy 6, the Shema prayer. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is God alone. Listen. St. Paul says in the New Testament, faith comes from hearing, when you listen to God. The tragedy, of course, is that Israel largely didn't listen. Now, the voice of God has become a human voice in the beloved Son. And the Father says, summing up all of salvation history, listen to him. This is why Peter, speaking for the three who are on the mountain, speaking for the 12, indeed speaking for all of Israel and the human race, says, Lord, it is good that we are here. Do you see the power of it? It's not just, oh, how wonderful that we're having this interesting mystical experience. Peter there is speaking for every single human being up and down the centuries. How good it is that we are here, that we are listening to the voice of God. When they heard the divine voice, the disciples, it says, fell prostrate. Now, it's not just because they're overwhelmed and afraid. That's true. But think of this. Prostration is the attitude of worship. They know where they are now, not in the presence simply of one more prophet, not in the presence of simply one more figure in the long history of salvation. They are standing, now they're lying prostrate in the presence of the very summation of the whole of Israel, the whole of salvation history. Friends, we are meant on this second Sunday of Lent to fall prostrate before that same Christ, that transfigured, metamorphosized, illumined culmination of Israel. And we must listen to him. And God bless you.